The final investigator I met with was Dr. Carol Huff, who specializes in multiple myeloma. And to help illustrate where we are with this rapidly changing disease, she presented a patient from her practice.
I recently saw a 55-year-old woman who originally presented to her primary care doctor about 3 years ago with actually complaints of joint and hand pain, but on incidental laboratory findings was found to have a mild anemia with a hemoglobin of 11.5. Her primary care doctor thought that she had some iron deficiency. She took iron for a while, nothing got any better, and she was ultimately referred to a hematologist about 2.5 years ago, had additional evaluation done, and was actually found to have multiple myeloma at that point in time. She had an M protein of 2.5 grams per deciliter. She had a hemoglobin of 11.5, normal albumin of 4.0, but her total protein was elevated at 10 and an IgG value of about 3,500. And she was diagnosed after a bone marrow biopsy with smoldering multiple myeloma.
And I'm sure one question that she had was, what do I expect from the future? What did you say to her?
So that's right. That was one of her first questions. What do I expect from the future? And unfortunately, somebody who's 55 years of age, I told her that we would expect that is likely in her lifetime she will progress to symptomatic myeloma, and probably within the 5-year range, given her constellation of percentage of plasma cells, the size of her M protein, or abnormal light chain, she had a greater than 50% chance of progressing within 5 years. I also have her look at things as the glass half full and say that there's also a 50% chance that you won't progress, but what we need to do is follow you closely.
And I'm sure she said, is there anything we can do to slow this process down?
She absolutely did. And unfortunately, I could not tell her at this point in time that there's anything to do, but I did tell her about the ongoing studies looking at, actually at the time they weren't ongoing, but the studies that are ongoing now, looking at perhaps using immunomodulatory agents in patients with high-risk smoldering myeloma.
I wanted to ask you about that because I think there was one report with lenalidomide. I think it was Dr. Mateos, was it?
Correct.
Can you talk about that and other research that's looked at this question?
Sure. So the question that is being studied is, can we change the natural history of smoldering myeloma? And up until this point in time, we really haven't had agents that we would even think about doing it from a side effect profile. But with the immunomodulatory agents, and in particular lenalidomide, which is well tolerated by most patients, we can begin to ask this question. And so there's a study that's ongoing randomizing patients who meet high-risk criteria, which she would actually fall in that category, randomizing them either to observation or to single-agent treatment with lenalidomide. And what they found, it's a very small, only reported in abstract thus far, but it found that there is a decreased risk of progression in those who receive lenalidomide versus those who receive placebo. Perhaps not surprising, because we're actually treating them with something, and so their markers are changing. We do not yet know if we've affected overall survival or any long-term outcome information.
So are there now phase 3 studies, big studies trying to look at this?
So there is a trial that the Eastern Cooperative Oncology Group is doing looking at the same approach, although they're using lenalidomide alone in this situation. I should say the Mateos trial actually had dexamethasone with it as well, too.
What would you say to a patient, maybe she even said this, who said, would you, you know, I've got kids or whatever, you know, I want every possible thing done, would you treat me off study?
So, in fact, she asked the question, would I treat her off study?
With lenalidomide?
With lenalidomide or with anything at
right.
that point in time. And in fact, she's been quite vigorous in taking her own supplements, doing her research and things she's trying to do. And I cautioned her. I told her I would not treat her off study because we don't yet know that this is going to make an impact. And I think that while now we have data, although when I first saw her, we did not have this data about decreased rate of progression, we don't know what that's going to do for the long-term overall survival. And I think that we should put patients on trials to try to answer these questions. I've encouraged her to participate in, well, I have encouraged her in the past to participate. At this point, actually, she is in need of therapy. But if she were not in need of therapy, I would encourage her to participate.
That was going to be my next question, which is, when was this and what's her current status?
So the first time I actually saw her was in August of 2009. She had been seen by another oncologist for about a year prior to that. I recently saw her within the last couple of weeks, and she has now progressed to the point that she meets criteria for symptomatic myeloma. So she's been followed, and one of the questions also is how often do you follow these patients? And I recommended to her to be followed every 2 to 3 months with serial CBCs, chemistry panels, and immunoglobulin and assessments with both immunoglobulin panel and serum protein electrophoresis, because what we're looking for is a criteria to treat her, one of these so-called CRAB criteria. So what she has now progressed to is an anemia with a hemoglobin of 8.5. So at the initial identification, her hemoglobin was 11.1. It is now 8.5. I should say she is clinically asymptomatic and does not want to start on therapy, but I've encouraged her to think about it at this point in time because she's only going to become more anemic before the therapies actually kick in, and she likely will become symptomatic.
Just to follow up in terms of your own kind of practice patterns, how often in these patients do you look at their bones?
So I typically look at their bones when they progress to the level of being symptomatic myeloma or if they have clinical symptoms that would warrant us looking at them.
So what kinds of treatments have you discussed with her, and what do you think is the best option for her right now?
So we have discussed a variety of different treatment options, looking either at 2-drug therapy versus 3-drug therapy. I've told her that I believe that she should receive at least lenalidomide or bortezomib as part of her upfront therapy, whether that is lenalidomide, bortezomib, dexamethasone, whether that is lenalidomide, dexamethasone, bortezomib, dexamethasone, or bortezomib, cyclophosphamide, dexamethasone. At some degree, I don't think we have a full answer to that. I have encouraged her to take the 3-drug combination, lenalidomide, bortezomib, dexamethasone. She is a less is more type of person, and although she wants to do everything she can, she's worried about side effects and would probably opt for 2 drugs versus 3 drugs.
And I imagine the subject of transplants come up?
Oh, the subject of transplant has in fact come up. And she is very much of the mindset that she would like to, once she gets treated, store her stem cells for a future transplant.
How do you decide whether or not to hold or, delay transplant in transplant-eligible patients? Is it something you decide ahead of time, or you wait and see how they respond?
So generally, we have an idea ahead of time as to whether we will transplant the person or not. But if they're not responding, then our plan may change slightly, escalate the therapy, and transplant sooner. I should say that our practice in general at our institution is not necessarily to transplant all patients in first remission, which may differ somewhat from other institutions.
What about the issue of post-transplant maintenance with lenalidomide in patients who do move forward with transplant?
So I think the question of maintenance is a very tantalizing question at this point in time, with at least 3 trials showing an improvement in progression-free survival. I have not routinely put all patients on maintenance therapy post-transplantation. And certainly patients who are in complete remission, I have not tended to put those patients on maintenance therapy. We don't yet know what ongoing therapy with these agents are going to do, long-term toxicity side effects, and whether there is any increased risks of other malignancies, which there may be some signal. I think it's very early and the numbers are very small. And there's also a cost factor to all of these agents, not just to the individual patient, but to healthcare in general. There have been reports from the maintenance trials suggesting that there were a few patients in the treatment arms that developed secondary tumors, some of which were hematologic in origin, some of which were not, on the immunomodulatory agents, so on the lenalidomide treatment arms. But I think the numbers are so small, we're talking less than 5 patients, that I think it's very early to know whether this means anything or not.
Why don't we talk about your 68-year-old man?
Sure. So I recently saw a 68-year-old gentleman who came to me with complaints of abdominal pain. I should say that he had already seen his primary care provider, who had ordered some laboratory studies which were unrevealing, a CT scan with IV contrast that did not show anything organically, although was noted to have multiple bone lesions on his CT scan, but 2 weeks later unfortunately presented to an outside hospital in renal failure, having had a normal creatinine when he was first seen.
These were lytic lesions in his bone?
They were lytic lesions.
So did they notice them, or what happened?
As a part of the evaluation, they did notice these. They were working him up.
They were working him, and he came in renal failure. What was his creatinine?
So his creatinine was actually 7.5 when he came to the emergency room. It was actually 1 prior to the CAT scan.
Wow.
When he got the IV contrast.
So you think that that contributed to it?
I think that the IV contrast likely contributed to his renal insufficiency. Yes, I do.
And did he have other manifestations clinically of acute renal failure?
He did not. He was making good urine. He had no symptoms of uremia or toxicity, just this sort of vague abdominal discomfort, which probably was, in retrospect, related to this.
So what happened?
So he actually had additional studies done, was found to have light chain myeloma with kappa light chains. He had about 7 grams of protein in his urine, of which 6.5 grams were kappa light chains. He had a bone marrow biopsy done that showed 90% plasma cells, and he was actually treated the same day.
And did you do that workup and treat him?
I did.
So what did you treat him with?
So the most important thing in patients who present with renal failure is to get their therapy started as soon as possible. So same day therapy. And the agents that I selected to give him were bortezomib, dexamethasone, and cyclophosphamide. And the reason for selecting those agents is that there is no need to dose adjust them for renal insufficiency. I had them readily available and could give them the same day for him.
Did he get plasmapheresis?
He did not get plasmapheresis.
How do you make that decision?
So in general, we have not plasmapheresed patients for acute renal insufficiency. The data doesn't really support the use of plasmapheresis, although certainly individual physicians and patients have had plasmapheresis. They have done well, but I think it's difficult to know. So in general, I do not plasmapherese patients with acute renal failure and light chain disease.
Was he dialyzed?
He was not dialyzed. He was making good urine. His electrolytes, potassium was normal, and he was not volume overloaded. So he did not have any indications for dialysis.
Have you heard about the strategy? Because I noticed a couple cases that were kind of like this, where you, I think maybe some people hold the cyclophosphamide and just start out with bortezomib and dexamethasone.
So
why is that, incidentally?
So I would not know for an individual case discussion, but I mean, a lot of people will use bortezomib and dexamethasone as two drug therapy, adding in the cyclophosphamide if you don't get response after 1 or 2 cycles. My rationale here was this man had acute renal failure, and I wanted to give him everything to try to get his kidney function better as quickly as I possibly could. And so in this situation, and I actually think the data with 3 drug regimens is quite compelling.
What's his current situation?
So he's actually finished his first cycle of therapy, and his creatinine has come down to 4. He continues to make good urine. His symptoms have all resolved. He has not had any electrolyte abnormalities, and I do not have results of his light chains or his 24-hour urine back as yet.
He's otherwise healthy?
He is an otherwise healthy gentleman with no medical history.
What about transplant for him?
So we would absolutely be going down the pathway of transplant for him once we get his disease into remission to move in that direction. And hopefully his kidney function will recover, although we still can transplant him if his kidney function does not improve to a normal baseline.
Do you see an IMID or lenalidomide in his future or in his immediate plan, so to speak?
So I don't see an IMID in his immediate plan, but I do see an IMID in his future. Again, his kidney function, while improved, has not normalized. You need dose adjustments for IMIDs in that sort of situation. That's one reason why I wouldn't do it. 2 is he's responding. And 3, whenever anybody has acute renal insufficiency, you can't get an IMID in a 1-day period of time or a 3-day period of time.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, would you think more about maintenance in a patient like this after transplant?
So I think it's certainly something to consider in someone such as him. I don't know that his myeloma would have caused him as much renal insufficiency if he hadn't gotten the IV contrast for his CAT scan. But at the time he got that, they did not have any idea what was wrong with him. He was treated entirely appropriately, had labs done beforehand. His creatinine was normal. His primary care doctor could not have anticipated that that was going to happen.
It's really bad luck, I guess, when
it
you
is,
think about it. Wow, interesting. So speaking about bortezomib, the other thing that kind of has come onto my radar that I'm trying to process is this presentation from ASH of sub-Q bortezomib. Can you talk a little bit about that and what you think about it?
Sure. So at ASH, there was a phase 3 trial presented looking at subcutaneous bortezomib versus intravenous bortezomib on the same schedule. And what they found nicely was that there was a significantly lower incidence of neurotoxicity from subcutaneous bortezomib versus the intravenous bortezomib. And it seemed to be associated with lower peak levels of the drug. So it was about a tenfold lower peak level of bortezomib with the subcutaneous preparation versus the intravenous preparation with the same efficacy. So I actually think that it's quite appealing and hope that it will move forward as a way of giving it to patients. Now, in the trial, they were using it twice weekly, so the standard schedule, but I think that weekly schedules of subcutaneous could also be looked at as well. I certainly use weekly dosing in people who have underlying neuropathy, either from their disease or underlying neuropathy from diabetes or a comorbid illness related to that. In the absence of that, I will start out at full dose dosing, and I usually give it twice weekly, but my first dose reduction is typically to go to once weekly versus changing the dose, maintaining a twice weekly basis. It's a friendlier schedule for patients to come to the office once a week versus coming twice a week, and I found that it works quite nicely to ameliorate the severity of the neuropathy.
Have you used it enough that clinically it kind of syncs up with what you've read in the literature?
It does. It does.
Interesting. Why don't we talk about your 69-year-old woman?
Sure. So I have a lovely 69-year-old woman who is actually quite vigorously active. In fact, is a triathlete who was initially diagnosed with symptomatic myeloma about 5 years ago, at which point in time she presented to her primary care doctor again with some complaints of fatigue and was found to have a hemoglobin of 8 and found to have light chain myeloma with lambda light chains at that point in time. Her bone marrow biopsy had about 80% plasma cells, and she too had a 11-14 translocation as well as some trisomies of chromosomes 3, 9, and 11 at that point in time. And given the time, the diagnosis would be treated differently at this point in time, but she was started on thalidomide and dexamethasone at that point in time and actually developed a rash 1 month into therapy, had to have her therapy interrupted, was re-challenged again with the thalidomide with dexamethasone and was able to tolerate it, but unfortunately her disease did not respond to the thalidomide-based regimen. And so she was changed to bortezomib at that point in time. Again, this is about 5 years ago. These are the agents that were available for use at that point in time. And her disease responded, but she had significant neuropathy related to it. And so we ultimately switched her over to a lenalidomide-based approach.
And what's her current situation?
So she's actually in a very good partial remission at this point in time. Her light chains are almost normal, and she is on maintenance lenalidomide as a single agent, currently on 10 milligrams a day.
No rash?
No rash.
Is there a cross, rash thing with the two IMiDs?
So I've seen it. I've seen patients who have a rash to one have a rash with another one, but even patients who have a rash to one or the other agent, you can often re-challenge them without recurrence. And in fact, that was done with thalidomide, and she never developed the rash again.
How do you conceptualize the mechanism of the rash, incidentally?
I really don't know.
Is it immunologic, do you think?
My guess is it's immunologically based.
In her case, and usually, is it pruritic?
So it is typically not pruritic. It is typically an erythematous maculopapular eruption that, in her case, was just present, didn't really bother her, but was just present.
And how is she doing on the lenalidomide?
So from a disease perspective, she's doing fantastic, and she really is tolerating the drug quite well. In fact, is competing in a triathlon in May.
Wow.
And has been fully functional and feeling exceptionally well, with the one exception of she has diarrhea on an ongoing basis as a side effect from the lenalidomide. And she finds it very frustrating because she finds it unpredictable when she is going to develop and when she's not. But when she does, she has to hurry up and get to the bathroom and has occasionally had near misses for accidents.
And again, what's known about the mechanisms involved?
So to my knowledge, I don't think anyone knows the mechanism of the diarrhea for lenalidomide, but certainly you see it in patients who are on it, and often the longer they're on it, the more likely it is that they develop this.
So have you tried to kind of play around with the dose? Or?
So we have. We've reduced her dose. She was initially on 15 milligrams. We've dropped her down to 10 milligrams. That has helped some. And we've played around with antidiarrheals. I most recently saw her, and we discussed going to 5 milligrams as a way of trying to reduce her dose further. She was a little apprehensive about that just because her numbers are doing well, and she decided that from her perspective, the diarrhea wasn't so bad that it was worth the potential risk of her numbers going up.
So what about transplanting her? She's 69, but she's a triathlete.
So we have discussed this at length. She is a highly educated physician and has looked at the data. We've talked about the data and feels that she would rather remain on medications than consider transplantation.
What do you see as the current role of thalidomide? To what extent, if any, do you use it?
So my use of thalidomide is extremely limited at this point in time. I will use it in an occasional older patient if I'm using a melphalan prednisone thalidomide-based regimen, or I will use it in later lines of therapy when patients are not responding to lenalidomide or bortezomib or combinations of those, recognizing it probably doesn't have all that much activity. But if I don't have a clinical trial and I don't have something, I will use some of the combinations.
What about pomalidomide? Can you discuss what it is? Do you think potentially it's going to become available? And if it does, again, you maybe see it in this woman's future. Would you try it if it were available now?
So pomalidomide is a third generation immunomodulatory agent, and it is highly active, in fact, active in patients where lenalidomide is not active. Martha Lacey's published the data about a year and a half ago. 40% of lenalidomide failures respond to pomalidomide. So just as thalidomide failures respond to lenalidomide, lenalidomide failures appear to respond to pomalidomide. We don't know the converse, meaning we don't know those who don't respond to pomalidomide, will they respond to the other agents? But it is nevertheless an active agent and quite promising. The toxicity seems to be predominantly hematologic in character with cytopenias, but does not appear to cause neuropathy and the other toxicities that we've seen, certainly with thalidomide and to some degree with lenalidomide. So if it were available, I think it would be something to consider in her. I don't think we know, however, what's going to happen long term. I mean, the diarrhea is not really an acute side effect of most lenalidomide patients. It's only something that you see down the line. So whether pomalidomide would do the same thing or not, I don't really know. My sense is she probably would be, I'll save that agent for when this one is not working. I'm quite content on my therapy right now.
Bringing up pomalidomide reminds me, I wanted to ask you, we were talking about bortezomib, sub-Q, weekly, but of course there's also carfilzomib out there. What is it and what do we know about it?
So carfilzomib is another proteasome inhibitor. It's got a slightly different mechanism of action. It's given a little bit differently than bortezomib. So bortezomib being given once or twice a week on a separated day schedule, carfilzomib is given 2 days in a row intravenously. It's about an hour infusion. Seems to have a slightly different side effect profile. It seems to have perhaps less neuropathy associated with it, more asthenia and fatigue. I think it's an active agent. I think it will likely become available for patients with myeloma. I'm not convinced that it's going to replace bortezomib, which I think some people had hoped that it might, but I'm not convinced that it will. Bortezomib is such an active agent in myeloma.
I think I'm reading you as kind of an RVD person.
Actually, I do use RVD, but I actually use a lot of Cyborg-D as well.
Right.
Too.
Okay. Because I was going to ask you about the presentation in ASH looking, I guess it's CRD, you know, replacing carfilzomib.
Correct.
Can you talk about that and what you thought about it?
Sure. So Andre Jakubowiak presented carfilzomib, lenalidomide, dexamethasone at ASH data showing very high response rates, higher complete response rates than the RVD or lenalidomide, bortezomib, dexamethasone regimen. I think it's a tantalizing combination. All of these agents are having such high response rates. I think it's going to be very difficult to sort one versus the other. And unfortunately, we have no head-to-head trials looking at them for survival differences. And I think those trials would be very difficult to do simply because a lot of patients go on to transplant, they go on to maintenance, and it's going to be very difficult to tease out what component is what. But I think many patients, if you're attentive to the neuropathy and you dose adjust, that I have found bortezomib to be quite a manageable agent.
So in what situations would you use RVD as opposed to Cyborg-D, if any?
So trying to think.
Yeah, you're thinking hard, so I guess not too many, huh?
Well, no, I mean, sometimes it's patient preference. I mean, I have many highly educated patients who come in and say, I want this RVD regimen. I've seen the phase 2 data. And I can't tell them that Cyborg-D is better than RVD, and I will do that in those sorts of situations. But I have tended to probably use more Cyborg-D, keeping lenalidomide in the IMiDs as a second line of therapy rather than exposing patients to all of the agents up front. I know there's concern you can use them and we can reuse them. I sort of like having a class of agents that the myeloma has not seen.
Yeah, that's a concept oncologists are familiar with. And a lot of people ask me about that in terms of myeloma because they're thinking about other cancers, metastatic breast cancer.
Well, and unfortunately, we don't cure myeloma with RVD or with Cyborg-D or with transplant. So we unfortunately have to think about that for patients with myeloma. And I know that there are many investigators out there who are convinced that this using all agents up front is not an issue.
And of course, you know, again, a common problem in oncology, having to compare indirectly between, you know, phase 2 studies. When you do that with Cyborg-D versus RVD or versus CRD, what do you come up with?
So I personally come with, I think they're relatively equivalent. I mean, I think they're phase 2 studies with nice numbers, but reasonably small numbers. And I think that I'm not convinced that they're that different.
So side note, you seem to favor Cyborg-D, which contains an alkylating agent, cyclophosphamide. In the B-cell lymphomas and CLL, we're hearing a lot about bendamustine. Have you used it in myeloma?
I've used it in myeloma. I don't use it in a lot of patients.
Single agent?
Actually, I haven't used single agent bendamustine. I've used it in combination with the newer therapies, with bortezomib, with lenalidomide, with dexamethasone. Dexamethasone not being a newer agent, but there is single agent data with bendamustine, but I think the combinations are probably more exciting.
And I take it that it's common for you and maybe a lot of people to repeat the novel agent, the proteasome inhibitor, usually bortezomib at this point, the IMID, I guess usually lenalidomide, maybe thalidomide. But am I hearing you say that maybe you'll use it in somebody who, quote, kind of progressed on it, but add in something else?
Yes, quite frequently.
Again, sort of breast cancer HER2-like.
I think, you know, not every patient who's gone through 6, 7, or 8 lines of therapy wants to go on to further therapy, but there are plenty of otherwise well patients whose myeloma is progressing and they feel well, they have excellent performance status, and yet they don't have available therapies. And so, yes, I do think, and these agents have activity. So these are, you know, drugs that are in phase 2, phase 3 trials at this point in time with activity.
Yeah, that's what I'm hearing. And I'm not sure that message is out there. How easy or difficult is it to, I guess, one issue we've heard from community oncologists is we've been taking care of these patients for a long time. You know, they like working with our staff. You know, now we got to send them to another doctor. Is that a reality?
I'm sure it is a reality. I mean, I'm sure that there are patients who do not want to travel. And even traveling, at least in my area, sometimes according to the referring physicians, they don't want to travel 15 miles to come to an academic center. They want to be cared for in the community. And so I think that having access of these trials in more community sites is ideal. But the reality of compassionate access is that most of the time these drugs that are available on compassionate use as they're going forward to trying to get FDA approval is there are usually expanded access programs, which then actually incur a cost to the center that wants to open the expanded access program, and it has to go through the IRBs, and you still are required to send in data. And so there frankly is not an incentive for programs to open these expanded access programs. And it's something that's been brought back to the pharmaceutical industry, but they have not been at least of the mindset or the ability to help support that. And so that's a challenge.
What about the patient who has neuropathy? How often is it that we're faced with a patient who either has neuropathy from the disease, which I'm not sure how easy or hard is it to define that, incidentally?
Not so easy, but what I can tell you is that the data with neuropathy from bortezomib is significantly less in lymphoma patients treated with bortezomib than it is in myeloma patients. So the assumption is that there is more underlying myeloma-related neuropathy in these patients that is subclinical and not necessarily detected. So if you take patients de novo with lymphoma and de novo patients with myeloma, you treat them with bortezomib, you're going to get a higher incidence of neuropathy in the myeloma population than in the lymphoma population. And so the belief is...
But I mean, if the neuropathy is sort of occurring with treatment and the treatment's reducing the tumor burden, wouldn't it be getting better?
Well, so then there's the treatment-related neuropathy. So bortezomib definitely leads to peripheral neuropathy, but the disease itself can also lead to neuropathy. And there is not good data looking at baseline EMG, nerve conduction studies, those sorts of things in myeloma patients. That said, we've actually done a trial looking at bortezomib and thalidomide without dexamethasone, which has been published, trying to identify a steroid-free regimen. And all those patients got baseline nerve assessments by the neurologist and follow-up. And there's a much higher incidence of baseline neuropathy than one might have appreciated just based on their history.
So again, you know, putting yourself in the oncologist's shoes, kind of trying to look at all these agents and all these different diseases, you know, again, you see something like T-DM1 and breast cancer, and patients have had 6, 7, 8 types of anti-HER therapy and they don't know what else to do, and the patient's progressing, they give them T-DM1, they have a response, you know, that means something. Does that happen with carfilzomib and pomalidomide?
It does.
Same kind of thing?
It does, the same type of thing. Not all patients, but there is definitely a percentage of patients, probably somewhere in the 20 to 30% of patients who have not responded or have progressed through multiple lines of prior therapy who will still respond to these agents. So they're definitely options for patients.
Any hypotheses about what's going on that, you know, they would have had, you know, one or two other IMIDs and yet they respond to pomalidomide, they've had bortezomib and respond to carfilzomib?
There are subtle differences in the mechanisms of action, and that, you know, there are cells that are still sensitive to them.
Is there any other new agent out there that's kind of in that class where you have data on responses and patients who progress through, you know, the other treatments? Any other agents that are that encouraging?
Well, and I think that it remains to be seen, but I think the elotuzumab data is certainly promising response rates. I think that it remains to be seen what will happen in bigger studies and those sorts of things.
So I've got one more big question for you. Cytogenetics in fish.
Uh-huh.
How about a 101 course that you would give to a fellow, sort of summarizing the bottom line?
Sure. So the bottom line for a newly diagnosed patient with myeloma, we would ideally like to have both cytogenetics and FISH on their initial bone marrow. I was actually asked this question 2 days ago. If you have circulating plasma cells in the blood, why do you need to bother getting the bone marrow? And from my opinion, you want the genetic data, and you're not going to be able to likely get it in someone who has enough circulating plasma cells to know that you're going to get it. So I believe that everybody should have a bone marrow with cytogenetics and FISH studies. If you can only get one, I'd prefer to have the FISH studies versus the cytogenetics, because the cytogenetics require metaphase growth, and myeloma cells do not grow all that well, so you have a much lower yield on cytogenetics than on FISH.
Incidentally, in what situations would you only be able to get one? Just not enough marrow?
Well, I've been asked by outside oncologists, you know, why do we have to do both? Cost basis, those sorts of things. So from my perspective, we get both all the time, because there are things that you can pick up on the karyotype that you won't pick up on FISH and vice versa. So they are useful.
So let's take it to the next level. What are the findings that'll change the way you approach a patient?
So the findings that would change the way I approach a patient, you're not going to get these back. And if you need to urgently treat somebody, you urgently treat them. But I think the high-risk ones that most people would agree upon are a 414 translocation, a 1416 translocation, and a 17P deletion. Most people would agree that those are all high risk, and a 13 deletion by karyotype. There are some others that have shown up on gene expression profiling and other sorts of things, but I think that's a very conservative, everyone would agree. If they have a 414 translocation or a 1416 17P, I would lean towards bortezomib as a part of my initial therapy, recognizing that the data suggests it's most effective in the 414 translocations, less so in the others, but I would lean towards bortezomib. It would help me from that perspective, and it would help me from transplant decisions.
Transplant decisions. More likely to go to immediate transplant if adverse?
Yes and no. I would lean in that direction. That said, we know that patients, at least pre-bortezomib with 414 translocations and 17P deletions, tended not to benefit from an autologous stem cell transplantation. Some of that negativity may have been abrogated by bortezomib at this point in time, but I would certainly lean those people towards high-risk trials, towards looking at novel approaches, because we know in general people who have high-risk disease with those genetic abnormalities don't do as well.
You know, I think another question that oncologists have is there's a lot of kind of confusion, and we talked about this already, but about the role of transplant today as opposed to 5 or 10 years ago. I mean, yes, you know, I mean, you verbalized, I think, what they hear from a lot of investigators, but I think they're looking for more of a gestalt. I think they have the feeling that we have these new drugs, they work better, and somehow that means transplant might not be as important. Is that true?
So I actually think that with the proliferation of new agents, that local oncologists or my referring physicians are more confused now. And in fact, one of them verbalized that to me a week or so ago. This is more complicated than it has been. So I think that there is a sense that transplant may not be as important at this point in time, although I actually think I'm getting more referrals in the era of these new agents for discussion of transplant consideration.
What about type of transplant? What situations, if any, does your institution, do you consider tandem or allo?
So we do not do tandem transplants at our institution. We will do a single autologous transplant. We will do allogeneic transplants in selected young patients who have an HLA identical sibling on a clinical trial.
Do you have a clinical trial right
we
now
do.
Doing that?
So we have ongoing clinical trials for allogeneic transplants. We do not have a myeloma-specific allogeneic transplant trial, but we have clinical trials asking questions of immune-based suppression and different ways of improving allogeneic transplants.
What do you say to a patient who says, what's the chance I'm going to die because of this transplant?
From an allogeneic transplant? So our institution data suggests about a 10 to 15% mortality rate from myeloablative allogeneic transplantation.
What about the issue of bisphosphonates and, I mean, bone-targeted therapy in general? Because I want to ask you about denosumab, but where are we with that?
So I think we're in the era of evolution with bone-targeted therapy at this point in time. When the bisphosphonates initially came out, pimidronate and then zoledronic acid, the initial approach was give it monthly for the rest of a patient's life. And as time has gone on and we've seen higher incidence, particularly of osteonecrosis over time, that has been modified. And most people at this point in time will give it monthly for patients who have bone disease, monthly for up to 2 years, and then reevaluate at that point in time. And the Mayo Clinic group has favored pimidronate over zoledronic acid, although I have not done that. We have tended to use more zoledronic acid than pimidronate.
And what about people without bone disease? Do you consider it? And what did you think about the MRC paper that suggests maybe an anti-tumor effect of zoledronic acid?
So the MRC data suggesting an anti-tumor effect, I think, is intriguing, although we have had other studies in the past that have not shown an improvement in survival for bisphosphonate therapy. So,
Do you think it's been looked at well in the other studies?
Well, perhaps the difference maybe is that we actually have better anti-myeloma therapy at this point in time, and so we may be able to actually see a difference, whereas before we weren't able to see a difference. I'm not ready to implement bisphosphonate therapy for everybody based on that trial. That said, so 80% of patients will have abnormalities typically on their skeletal survey, which will give them bisphosphonate therapy. Those who do not, I do a more exhaustive look for bone lesions, either in the form of a bone density scan or in the form of a PET CT or an MRI of the spine to look for occult bone lesions that would then drive me to give them a bisphosphonate. So most patients end up getting it. There are selected patients who don't have any evidence of bone disease, and I haven't given it to them.
In what situations will you give less than 2 years, if any?
So certainly if somebody develops osteonecrosis, and this is somewhat controversial too, but I would typically stop the bisphosphonate at that point in time if they develop osteonecrosis and wait for that to heal up and then consider restarting it at that point in time. But if somebody achieves a complete remission and has no evidence of active myeloma, I think you can consider giving less than 2 years of therapy.
And what about continuing? What are some of the reasons you...
Some of the reasons I continue are patients who have ongoing active myeloma that is not responding to therapy or ongoing fractures or bone-related events.
Maybe you can kind of clarify for me the denosumab situation. I thought it was going to play out, you know, very straightforward. Everything's going probably, you know, breast cancer, we're talking about it, prostate cancer, and then not so sure I understand what's going on with myeloma.
So the denosumab data with myeloma is the drug is FDA approved for breast cancer, prostate cancer, but not for myeloma. And that is based on the fact that there were insufficient numbers of myeloma patients treated with denosumab on the trials for the company to feel that they had enough data to pursue an indication for myeloma. So they are now doing a trial in myeloma patients to try to get sufficient data to expand their label indication.
And there were data suggesting more deaths?
So, correct. So in the data that's available, there was a suggestion of higher numbers of deaths of myeloma patients with denosumab versus zoledronic acid. Unfortunately, the arms were not completely matched as far as stage of disease and activity of disease, and I suspect that probably the differences are going to sort themselves out from that perspective, but we'll have the phase 3 data forthcoming.
Is there a potential or a real role for the drug in people with renal dysfunction?
So I think that that's where the role of denosumab will be, in my perspective, in myeloma, in patients who have renal dysfunction, because there does not appear to be any renal toxicity and you do not need to have renal monitoring. And so that's the patient population that I am thinking that it's going to have the greatest utility in myeloma.
Would you use it now if you could?
So I would and have in a particular patient with renal dysfunction and progressive bone disease that the nephrologist felt he absolutely could not receive bisphosphonate therapy.
Is there an indication for myeloma with renal dysfunction?
Yeah.
Can you get it?
So I was able to get it.
Oh, you were able to. Yeah, you said you treated somebody. Yeah.
I think it remains to be seen what the payers are going to pay for. This patient also had osteoporosis, although the osteoporosis indication is for postmenopausal osteoporosis. So I couldn't get it on that basis.
It's interesting because I'm hearing oncologists and investigators talk about using it in breast cancer. I mean, it's obviously indicated. Theoretically, when you think about the mechanism involved, would you predict that it would be effective, or is there any reason to think it wouldn't be?
There's no reason to think it wouldn't be, and I don't think there's any reason to think that it would accelerate deaths in myeloma patients versus bisphosphonate.
And if somebody were to say to you, is the reason we don't have data on this because we don't have enough data, or because we have data and it doesn't work?
So we know that the drug works in bone lesions for breast and prostate cancer, and it was a strategic decision to not specifically try to target myeloma when the drug was being developed. I think in retrospect, a decision that the company regrets because they thought they would have enough patients in their catch-all trial that included all other diseases and discovered that they didn't and now are going back to do a phase 3 trial on myeloma itself. So I don't think the lack of data means, I think the lack of data is just we don't have the data for the FDA.
Right. I remember the old, the lack of evidence is not evidence of a lack of effect or
Correct.
Something. Yeah.